Welcome to The Water Table, the podcast that floats slowly, spreads widely, and sinks deeply into conversations about the human relationship with land, water, and community. I'm your host, Pete Tanin. My guest today is Emily Fairfax. Dr. Fairfax is an assistant professor of environmental science and resource management at Cal State University Channel Islands and an assistant adjunct professor at Utah State for watershed sciences. If her name sounds familiar, it likely is. She's been all over the media lately, most recently on NPR's All Things Considered and Science Friday, where she's been sharing her research, which focuses on the eco-hydrology of riparian areas, particularly those that have been impacted by beaver damming. She uses a combination of remote sensing, modeling, and fieldwork to understand how beaver damming changes landscapes and on what timescales those changes operate. Emily, welcome to The Water Table.
Thank you. I'm super happy to be here.
Emily, you are a popular expert folks are calling upon in these times. Shows like CBS Sunday Morning and PBS. I saw you on Yale Climate Connections, The Guardian, BBC, Grist, and so many others. Beavers seem to be having a moment where their ability to accelerate ecosystem restoration is being recognized. To what do you attribute so much demand for your time and knowledge in this area of expertise?
That's a great question. I think a lot of it comes down to the fact that these last couple of years have been really apparent in how bad climate change has gotten. We are having these mega droughts, we're having these mega fires, we're seeing extreme flooding, and a lot of people are realizing the ways that we've managed the landscape for the last 100 years are not working. And we need to be more creative and we need to think outside the box. And what could be more outside the box than turning over the controls to a large semi-aquatic rodent? And I think that a lot of people are finally starting to engage with the idea that people don't have to be in charge of restoring the landscape. There's other organisms out there that already do this, especially beaver, and they want to learn more about how that process works, because what could be better than sort of letting someone else take the reins and fix it for you?
Beavers, of course, have been extirpated from much of their historical range in California. The state is sorely missing their dam and canal building activities, and we're feeling the effects of their absence in the form of megafire, drought, and aquifer depletion. We're hopeful that their eventual reintroduction will mitigate these impacts, but in the meantime, we need to get going on mimicking the beaver's effect on the landscape, slowing, spreading, and sinking water. Have you seen the effective use of beaver dam analogs in California?
Yeah, I've actually seen a number of really effective beaver dam analog projects from Northern California into the Sierras and the Tuolumne. They're just about to start doing it in Paso Robles. So we're seeing this becoming a more widespread tool that people are looking to. And I think that's great, because when you talk about beavers and beaver-based restoration, it really is a spectrum. So you could be all the way at one end where you have beavers and you're supporting them, and that's great. Or you could be all the way at the other, where you're in a heavily degraded system, there's barely any water left, but you want to start fixing it. You can't wait for the beavers. Maybe the beavers can't even live in that landscape yet. It's so degraded. So how do you start that restoration process? And things like beaver dam analogs are definitely one of the ways to do that. Anything that sort of falls under this umbrella of what's called low-tech process-based restoration is going to nudge those streams and those rivers and those riverscapes back into this more natural, resilient, and self-sustaining state.
You mentioned Tuolumne County, which is where the Land Resilience Partnership started with the Tuolumne County Resource Conservation District. And with the LRP, we use this metaphorical water toolkit, where we provide physical and conceptual tools for homeowners to increase their water and land resilience. We recently added a beaver analog tool, and some of our partners up by Yosemite, in Ackerson Meadow in particular, are using beaver dam analogs where they're trying to reverse some of the heavy grazing damage and trying to retain more water. But it's also doing a lot more than that, as your research has shown, that the presence of beaver dams mitigates the severity of wildfire.
Yeah. So when you think about a riverscape, so the stream itself, the floodplains, the riparian corridor, that ecosystem that sort of surrounds the river, it should be one of the most resilient habitats that we have. Unfortunately, when you do have pressures like overgrazing and aridification and land use change, they can become really degraded and sort of unstable. And so you disconnect the stream from its floodplain, and if you have a drought or a fire come through, what used to be this really robust ecosystem is incredibly fragile. But you can change that. So if you have beaver dam analogs, if you have beavers, you can push the stream back into a more resilient state so that there's all this water being stored in the surface water system. So it's in ponds, it's in canals, it's in streams, but then also in the soil all around it. And when it's in the soil, plant roots can access it even when we don't have rain, even if we're in a mega drought. And that's really important because if you think about wildfires, when a wildfire does come through a landscape, it's going to take the path of least resistance. So it's going to burn the driest, crunchiest, most desiccated fuels. And the fuels around beaver complexes or around restoration sites are greener and they're wetter. And so if the fire is coming through, it's energetically unfavorable to burn that. It's harder to burn. You don't go out and try to start your campfire with a big pile of wet leaves. Or if you have done that, you've probably learned quite quickly, it's a bad idea. It doesn't work very well. It's hard to start a fire that way. You go get the dry stuff. And so really what river restoration is doing and what beavers and beaver-based restoration is doing is it's creating big soggy patches in the landscape. And those soggy patches, ultimately, they're just hard to burn because they're wet. It sounds pretty simple, and it is pretty simple. Like, this isn't rocket science. This is just the natural functioning of the landscape. And it's actually kind of intuitive when you think about it.
It also creates a sort of refugia, right? Which is especially critical in high severity fire.
Yeah. So in the American West, we've lost somewhere between 80 and 90% of our wetlands over the last 200 years, and about 95% of riparian habitat has been degraded or lost as well. And so that's a massive loss of this type of habitat on a continental scale, to be honest. And if you think about maybe a fire happening 300, 400, 500 years ago, there were all sorts of patches where animals could go and hunker down when the fire's coming through. If you are a fish or a frog or a bird or a small mammal, just find your nearest wetland and wait it out. But today, those landscapes are so rare to find. And so these beaver complexes, what they're doing is they're filling a function that used to be abundant in the landscape. We used to have lots of wet patches that weren't going to burn. And now we have so few, and it's really, the beavers are doing a great job of making them. And so if you are a fish or a frog or whatever, today, trying to escape these increasingly intense and destructive wildfires, one of your safe paths is to find the nearest beaver complex. And what I've seen in my research is that when you have fires move through a landscape, as they approach beaver complexes, they're so wet that even high severity fires with really intense burning sort of fizzle out and are not able to get all the way into the beaver complex. You maintain intact habitat. The willows have their leaves. All of the trees are doing fine. There's grasses, there's plants, there's water. And that patch is essentially unburned or maybe really, really lightly burned. It has good fire, if any fire. It doesn't get sort of obliterated like we're seeing in these catastrophic megafires.
I would love to see trail cam footage of one of these beaver complexes during a fire and just watching the influx of biodiversity coming to seek shelter. I've seen photos of, you know, bears lounging in the pools of a complex during a fire.
We've seen bears. Some photos out of Colorado just showed otters that were hanging out in beaver ponds up in the Cameron Peak, Burn Scar area. We've seen grazers go to these places and wait it out. There's definitely fish that are mature that we find in beaver ponds after fire. I would love to get game camera footage, but it's hard because you don't know where it's going to burn. And I'm not in the business of starting my own wildfires. So it'd take a pretty large network of game cams to get that perfect shot. I'd love to see it. And I do know a lot of people place game cams for hunting or recreation or other things. And so if anybody is listening who has game cams and has seen this footage, please tell me. I would love to see it.
Emily, on our walk earlier, you mentioned California has lost something like 95% of its riparian areas, including wetlands. California recently became the first state to adopt the 30 by 30 goal, which seeks to protect 30% of land and waters by the year 2030. The idea seems to be gaining traction, at least on the marine front, with the Chumash Heritage National Marine Sanctuary moving forward. And I don't know if the 30 by 30 plan means you can conserve any land area and say it's part of that total being conserved, or if the state is trying to get up to 30% of all the different ecosystem types out there, because if only 5% of riparian areas from pre-colonization are remaining, the state has a lot of work to do. And it's hard to imagine that happening without partnering with the beaver, the engineers of riparian habitats.
Yeah, the details of 30 by 30, I think, are still being ironed out, but riparian habitat is a really important thing to consider because they are disproportionately important in the landscape. In arid and semi-arid places, it's estimated that 80% of terrestrial vertebrates use riparian corridors at some point in their life. They either go there to lay their eggs, or they go there to feed, or it's their main water source. So these are habitats that serve almost everything in the landscape. Whereas if you're just looking at a patch of pine forest or a patch of grassland, those are definitely ecologically important, but they don't have quite the same disproportionate value when you think about this area as a region or as a continent. And so in 30 by 30, I know one of the things that's been proposed is looking more towards nature-based solutions, which is sort of the catchphrase for making our ecosystems be able to sustain themselves and sort of taking our hands out of the mix. So a lot of them are in a state right now where they are not self-sustaining. They are degrading and probably getting worse in a lot of ways. But if we can restore some of these processes that are natural, physical processes and ecological processes, then we can slowly back away and it will continue to get better on its own. Because these are natural systems that were in a very productive and healthy, balanced state for thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of years. And it's really just in the last couple hundred years that they've become so degraded and so dangerously, precariously balanced at the precipice of either being a functioning habitat or just being completely lost altogether.
I heard you mention the idea of ecological amnesia in one of your talks. When we talk about nature-based solutions like beavers, our imaginations for how it could all look with beavers back in the landscape feels kind of limiting, you know? Like, we are sitting here in Ojai on unceded Chumash land where I grew up, and I've never known a different hydrological regime than basically bone bleached dry creek beds in the summertime and a muddy looking flashy torrent of water in the winter. It's hard to imagine how it might have flowed differently, say without a dam on our main tributary and with beavers on the landscape and all of the tree life that would have, that they would have supported, and how radically different that landscape would have looked. We have ecological amnesia, but we also have a current failure of our present imagination. And not just in Ojai, we're talking about basically everywhere in California, right? Where beavers existed, save for the high desert.
Yep. Yeah, they were everywhere. And the ecological amnesia, it is something that's discouraging, but it also gives me hope at the same time, because I've talked to so many very environmentally focused people who want the earth to be healthier and they want nature to be stronger. And when they see a beaver move in, they're like, uh-oh, this beaver is hurting the trees. It's cutting them down. And it's like they're saying those things out of a place of concern. Like they're worried about the landscape, but they don't realize or they don't remember that beavers should be there. And like we're living in the altered state right now. This continent used to have so many more beavers than we have today. And there are so many indigenous knowledge holders that know that, and they've known that for thousands of years. And so the fact that environmentalists and people today are like, uh-oh, is the beaver good or bad? Like to some extent, that feels like a silly question to ask because the answer's already out there. These animals coexisted very peacefully with humans for a long time. And when we go forward with things like low-tech process-based restoration and beaver reintroduction, it's really important to remember that, yes, looking at data and studies and science like mine is great, but also listening to people and to stories is important because there are people who remember what this landscape looked like with beavers on it. They just often are being ignored.
Yeah. How do we know where there were beavers historically?
One of the ways that it was proved that beavers are native to California is there is a large sort of archaeological/social/anthropological effort to figure out the evidence of beavers in California. And there were all different kinds of evidence that were brought into this. There were museum specimens, there were fossils, there were pictographs, there was indigenous words for beaver, there were stories about beavers, there were trapper journals. And bringing all of that data together, we realized like, oh, duh, beavers are of course native here. Like, why else would there be such a rich history of them in this landscape if they had not been here for so long? And so that kind of sort of information gathering where you use a lot of different sources, both physical and social, can put a much clearer picture together of what the landscape and what the beaver situation looked like before sort of the advent of modern Western science.
I mean, on the Sisquoc River, just to the north and west of Ojai, there is a Chumash pictograph on a rock that is unmistakably that of a beaver. It has the body and the legs and a big flat tail coming off of it. And in Sespe Creek in 1906, a beaver skull was recovered and is now one of the only beaver skulls in a museum in California.
Yeah, we're kind of lucky that beavers are such a unique looking animal, because you know when you're looking at a picture of a beaver, like, it's pretty obvious. And there are still beavers up on the Sisquak, so that is a nice example of it being kind of full circle. Like, the pictograph is there, they've been there for a long time, and they're still here today, and that's great. The CESPE is a maybe slightly less hopeful example, because they were there, we know they were there, we have the specimens, but as of today, there's no active evidence of beaver living in that space. We had beavers in CESPE and in Ventura County as recently as the late 90s and 2000s, but after that, I haven't heard of any sort of recent sightings of a live beaver, which is a bummer, because they definitely belong here, and they were here for a long time. But it's also exciting, because that means that this is a landscape that is a perfect target for things like beaver-based restoration and bringing back the sort of healthy riverscapes that we used to have.
Yeah, when I looked on iNaturalist to see if there had been any beaver sightings in the area lately, the only one I came across was a photo that had been logged by you in CESPE Creek of a pretty large piece of wood, tree trunk, that was very clearly gnawed on by a beaver.
Yeah, I feel like they've got to be here somewhere. Like, half of Ventura County is forest land, basically. And I have definitely not hiked all of those trails and all of those streams and all of those rivers. And beavers have learned ways to avoid people and to hide from us. So I wouldn't be surprised if there are beavers out there, but the population is not large enough that they're being routinely seen or observed. But I went and found that stick because I was like, come on, there's got to be beavers here. And so I was just hiking through the creeks and through the riparian zone looking for anything I could find that indicated the presence of beavers. And I saw that stick and I was like, this is the hope I needed.
Do you think that that beaver was one of the descendants of the beavers that were pushed out of airplanes with parachutes on in the middle of last century?
It's possible. So in, like, I think it was the 1940s or so, the state of California did try to reintroduce beavers to a lot of Central and Southern California. And I think somewhere like 40-ish individuals were brought into the CESPE wilderness. And as far as I can tell, that population did all right. There are people who I've had personal conversations with that have come to talks or come to chat with me, and they're like, oh yeah, I totally see beavers swimming all the time up on the CESPE back in the 70s. It was great. Like, I could routinely go out for a hike and they'd slap their tails at me. And if you're not super familiar with the creek living animals, it's pretty much just beavers that slap their tails at you. So that's a telltale sign of beaver activity.
Telltale.
Yeah, I got one in. But then they say, like, oh, but then as of, like, I haven't seen one since 2001. I haven't seen one since 1995. And that makes me wonder, like, did they leave? Were they killed? Did they move further into the wilderness? Beavers don't often get along with people when we're trying to utilize the same habitats. And so maybe the increasing presence of hikers and campers and cars pushed those beavers further up into the wilderness. I don't know. I think it's the kind of project that would take a massive on-ground effort to really figure out if there are still beavers here, and if there are, where are they?
What do you look for as a sign that beavers either are or were present in a place in the past?
The easiest sign to find, I think, is beaver chewed sticks. So beavers will chew down trees and break up sticks into smaller pieces. They eat the layer that's sugary between the bark and the wood itself, called cambium. And their chew pattern is really signature. Like, it looks like a little pencil if they chewed at it from both sides, and it looks kind of like a slash through the tree if they've just come at it one side. And you can see their teeth scrapes. Like, it is obvious this is chewed. It's not a saw. It's not some trail manager coming through and clearing brush. Like, an animal did this. And you can see those on trees that are still in the ground. You can see these sticks floating down rivers. You can see them in flood deposits. And if you find these sticks, that is beaver. Like, there's no other animal that's doing this. And then more obvious, I guess, would be the beaver dam. So if you have beavers that have truly colonized a site, they will build dams, which are big channel-spanning structures, and they look like what you think they'd look like. Like, it's a dam. And then there is a pond behind it. And there's no other animal other than people that build dams that way. So that's another really unique beaver behavior. You might also see their lodges or bank burrows, but that can take a little bit more of a trained eye. It just looks like a pile of sticks. But looking more closely, all of those sticks have been chewed by the beavers. And so that's, again, the beaver chew comes in, like, that's what you're looking for.
Yeah.
And if you're out at night hiking and you hear a big, loud, slappy sound in the water, like, that is how beavers tell you to go away. That is them slapping their tail and warning the other beavers, hey, there's a weird predator here, go hide. And they will also slap to try to tell you, like, get out, I'm big and scary, which is not entirely true. They are big, but I don't think beavers are super scary.
You know, we talked earlier about ecological amnesia and failure of imagination. And one of the things that comes up for me is trying to imagine how Chumash cultural burning would be done at the end of the summer in what is traditionally our fire season, and trying to imagine how that was done in a way without these fires just getting wildly out of control and spreading into the chaparral. And I remember, oh yeah, there were beavers on this landscape. It was a much wetter, spongier place where, you know, probably the Ojai Valleys were a braided creek system in the Ventura River. You look at how wide that river plain is, and this was probably a meandering waterway. There was simply a lot more water on the landscape, and it didn't look like the way it does now. Fires were probably easier to contain and manage.
Yeah, they looked so different. And they're, like, when you think about burning in the landscape and prescribed fire or cultural fire or any kind of fire, really, it is going to be really dependent on the fuels, how that fire behaves. And the fuels are plants, and they're what it looks like. And if you're doing routine burning, that's going to clear off a lot of this brush that can become really flammable. And then the beavers are doing their work in these riparian zones. They're keeping, you know, the trees pruned, and they're adding a lot of moisture to the soil, and they're creating these big bands that are really low flammability. And so the river network can almost act like this sort of web of slow patches, of speed bumps. And so if the fire does maybe start to get a little out of control, as it approaches a really healthy riparian zone, that's going to slow it down. And people who are practiced in fire and in burning, at that point, that's a really easy way to get a hold on it. Like, okay, the fire was naturally slowed, so now let's get it back under the kind of containment or push it in the direction that we originally wanted. And the idea of beavers being sort of partnered on to cultural burning is not new. You can look up beavers and brush, and it's out of Northern California, and it's all about the traditional partnership between cultural burning and beavers, and how you partner that, the burning off of the brush and the brush clearing, with the beavers rewetting the landscape, and your end result is just this incredibly resilient and healthy system that can support things that a lot of people care about, like salmon and, you know, having abundant water year round and having that water be clean and clear and useful and healthy. And this is, again, like, I can't say enough, this isn't new knowledge. It's just something that has not been talked about enough.
In California, we talk a lot about the decline of our anadromous fish. In this watershed in particular, the Ventura River watershed, the loss of our steelhead trout is an indicator of the dramatic decline of our ecosystem health. When you remember that these fish begin their migration to spawn in the fall, it raises the question, how is that even possible? These creeks are bone dry until basically December at the earliest. And then you remember this watershed is missing its chief engineer, the organism that kept water on the landscape. It wasn't just overfishing or groundwater pumping that depleted our in-stream flows and killed the steelhead habitat. It was also the loss of a keystone species, the beaver. Can you talk a little bit about what exactly we're missing without having the beaver here?
Yeah, it's hard to really conceptualize what it means to have lost 95% of riparian habitat and to have had our rivers altered that much. I was just recently looking at some data from what's called the National Hydrography Dataset, and it is basically where all of the streams and creeks and rivers are. It's traces you can look at on maps. And I was looking at them overlaid on satellite and aerial images, and I'd zoom in on some of these creeks, and I'd be like, that's not a creek. Like, this is just, this line is literally going through some, like, grassland. Like, this isn't a creek at all. And then I stop and I remember, like, okay, this should be a creek. This would be a creek, but we have so little water, and the groundwater is, like, very much over-extracted in a lot of the West that it no longer functions as a creek. And that creek could have been habitat for steelhead. That creek could have been habitat for all sorts of different organisms. Like, we have birds, we have amphibians, we have fish, we have a lot of these creatures. Like I mentioned, they depend on having reliable water sources and having these really biodiverse ecosystems where they can eat a boatload of bugs and not spend so much energy walking around the landscape looking for their next source of food or of water. And so when we lost beaver, when we lost the functioning sort of behaviors in a lot of these riverscapes, that's losing habitat for so much more than the beaver itself. I am definitely somebody who thinks beavers are great, and I'm very happy to see people getting on board with beaver-based restoration, but you don't actually have to love beavers to love what they're doing and mm-hmm. love what they can do in the landscape.
Right.
You can be a hunter and absolutely love hunting waterfowl. And if that's the case, beavers should be your best friend, because I have never seen so many ducks as I do when I visit my field sites, and it's a beaver pond and it's just like 1 trillion ducks.
Yes.
I have game cameras out and I cannot get through the footage fast enough because it's just video after video of duck families walking by. And I'm like, ugh, these ducks. But if you're a hunter, that's great. The beaver has provided an abundance of ducks for you. If you're a fisher, the number of fish in these ponds that are way larger and way healthier than the fish you see outside of them, it's astounding. Like, these fish have so much food they can eat, and the water is slower, so they're not spending so much energy swimming against the current. So it's basically a place where fish can go bulk up, get huge, and then go on with the rest of their lives. And if you're a fisherman, you want to get those bulked up huge fish. Like, that's mm-hmm. the fun thing to catch.
Yeah.
And so you can come at this from all sorts of different angles. If you're a farmer, this is going to replenish groundwater. And if you want to pump that groundwater, great. Let's put some more in so that you can continue pumping it into the future. Being a sustainable steward of riparian zones really does benefit everyone. Even if you don't personally spend time in the riparian zone, having them back in a more healthy functioning state is going to benefit you.
It's not just about the fish. It's not just about the beaver. What we're talking about here is enhancing the life-supporting capacity of landscapes for everyone, for all things.
Absolutely. I mean, riparian zones are incredibly rich in natural resources. The water, the sand, the soil, the gravel, the animals, the plants. There is so much there that can provide benefits throughout the landscape. So when you talk about landscape restoration, when you talk about 30 by 30, I think you have to include riparian zones in that, because they are truly part of all of these different places.
I just saw an image of a creek in Doty Ravine, California, where they set up some beaver dam analogs. And within a short period of time, they had seen an 800% increase in the riparian zone due to the spreading of the water from these beaver dam analogs.
Yeah, they set up BDAs. Yeah, I love that story. It's really impressive. And it's also the source of like one of my favorite jokes, which is beavers are the only engineers that come in ahead of schedule and under budget, which is really true, because with that restoration project, they were expecting it to take many years to restore that riparian zone. And they were expecting to spend on the order of millions of dollars. And then when they built these BDAs, and I do believe beavers actually came and helped out a little bit in that situation too, what they saw was that the restoration was accelerated and the costs were much, much lower. Like, instead of being on the order of millions of dollars, we're on the order of tens of thousands to hundreds of thousands of dollars. And when you think about climate change, it can be really overwhelming. There's so much work to do, and beavers can't do all of that work. There's stuff that we need to handle as well. But all of these actions cost money. And if you can free up some of those dollars, you can redirect them towards other climate change actions. And so by allowing beavers and beaver-based restoration to take a significant role in riparian restoration, you are also supporting using money and using resources and using personnel for things the beavers can't do. Like, a beaver's not going to go start a prescribed fire. We definitely should see some more prescribed fires happening. So let's redirect some of that money into other landscape restoring actions.
Yes, yes. I'd like to go back to the BDA and talk a bit about what people can do in their individual spaces, like what a BDA is and when it's appropriate, and what other things people can do in their yards, on their land, to best mimic the effect that beavers have on the landscape.
Yeah, so with beaver-based restoration, there is the side of like letting beavers do the work that beavers should be doing. And that's really important. Like, we should absolutely let beavers be beavers. But then there's also learning from beavers and mimicking beavers. And sometimes that does mean building a beaver dam analog. So if you're going out to build a beaver dam analog or a BDA, that is a structure that looks like a beaver dam, kind of, that people build, and it's more or less effective. But really, the goal of a beaver dam analog should be to attract beavers or to create habitat that is suitable for real beavers in the future. And not every situation is maybe ready for a beaver dam analog. And that doesn't mean you're out of luck, because there's a lot of other ways that we can learn from beavers and apply sort of beaver-based ideas without actually building the beaver dam ourselves. So when you think about it at its core, the beaver dam is slowing down the water and spreading it out and starting to reconnect the stream with its floodplain. So if you're in a really, really incised stream, you can accomplish a lot of work by literally throwing some logs in the water, like add wood to these rivers. Rivers should have a lot of wood in them. They should have wood on the floodplains. They should have wood in the stream channel itself, and a lot of them don't have any. sometimes people think that streams should be nice and tidy and, you know, beautiful, picturesque things, and they really shouldn't. They should be messy and chaotic, and it should be hard to walk through the riparian zone and get down to the water itself. So step one, just put some wood in the river. Mm-hmm. Another thing you can do is maybe you're beyond the point of just adding some wood. There are other things called PALs, or post-assisted log structures. And this is like halfway between a log jam or just some wood in the river and a full-blown beaver dam analog. You still are putting in posts, but then you're just adding sort of logs to it. It's not quite as intentional as a beaver dam analog. And some of the really early beaver dam analogs actually looked a lot like the PALs we see today. Now, the modern beaver dam analog, BDAs have been studied a lot in the last 5 or so years because people are really trying to understand, are these effective? What makes them effective? And how can we improve them? Because beavers, they've got it down. Like, they build the perfect beaver dam analogs because they're real beaver dams. We're not there yet. We're still learning. We're in beaver school. And what we're finding is that the beaver dam analogs that are really effective, like, they really do look like beaver dams. So instead of using our human brains and being like, okay, we're going to put in posts and they're going to be really deep into the stream bed, and then we're going to weave willow super tight through it. Instead of doing that, you know, take a step back and be like, okay, we're going to add some sort of a foundation to this structure. And then we're going to lay the logs the way the beavers lay the logs. Does my human brain say that's not the most efficient engineering? Yes. But the beavers have proven me wrong. So I'm going to take that step back and build it like the beavers build it. And what we're seeing with these more modern, like really beaver-esque beaver dam analogs is that they can be pretty effective, at least in the short term, at accomplishing some of the goals that you would want in that landscape, you know, reconnecting the floodplain, slowing sinking and storing the water. But again, it's going to be so much better if the beavers move in and help us in the long run. So for now, we're in beaver school. We're still learning to build better beaver dam analogs, trying to mimic the specific parts of them that make them so effective. But we're also partnering with the beavers and letting the beavers be beavers. So there's let the beavers do their thing, and then there's learn from the beavers. And if we can do both of those things, we're going to be on the best path for success.
So when can we get a pilot project in the Ventura River? I mean, we have a big concrete dam in the way, which the time horizon for its removal is looking like 2035. Hopefully it's sooner. But when you look at Ventura County and Ojai in particular, we've warmed faster than anywhere else in the continental United States. Our average temperature has increased nearly 5 degrees Fahrenheit since the industrial era. Why? Well, a big part of it is land use change, including the extirpation of the beaver. When the beaver was here, there was a lot more water on the landscape. And so if you think if there's more water in the landscape, there were more trees. It was cooler. They were sequestering more carbon. The landscape was more resilient to wildfire and aridification. It's kind of all the things that we need right now. When you reduce it all down, the answer for one of the most effective things that we can do to both adapt and mitigate the climate crisis is reimagining our relationship with water. And part of that means reestablishing our partnership with the beaver. And that idea is catching on with the state, using beavers as a means of process-based restoration. It's being included in the state's toolkit.
Yeah, I think the Ventura River watershed is a really great place to really embrace low-tech process-based restoration and beaver-based restoration, and hopefully eventually beaver reintroductions. Currently, you can't relocate beavers in California. There's policies that go back a long time saying no moving these live rodents. But you can do relocation in many other states, and I hope that California will follow suit in the near future. But in the meantime, we know beavers used to be in the Ventura River watershed. We know beavers are in pretty much every county around us. They're in Santa Barbara County, they're in San Luis Obispo County, they're in Kern County. They're even between LA and San Diego. Like, we are this void on the beaver map, which is abnormal. And so because it's so abnormal, it makes me feel like this is a very ripe place to get it ready for beavers. They're all around us. They will definitely continue to be beavers and have their young and disperse further and further along the river networks. It's only a matter of time before the beavers that are over on the Santa Ynez River or the beavers that are up on the Salinas River start trickling into our watersheds. And that's going to be a really crucial time. Either they come in and they find this severely degraded landscape that is not hospitable to them, and then they die or leave. Or they come in and they find a landscape that's already been sort of primed for their reintroduction. We've got beaver dam analogs all throughout the rivers. We've done post-assisted log structures. We've put wood into the rivers. We've restored that habitat already so that when the beavers come in, they're just going to take up maintenance and they're going to make it go faster and accelerate that restoration, just like they did up in Doty Ravine and just like they've done in so many other places around the American West. And if you spend a few minutes just Googling ranch restoration beaver or incised stream beaver restoration, you can find these incredible success stories from private landowners, from public lands, where they start a restoration project and it's going fine, and then beavers show up and then it goes great. And we could have that in Ventura County.
That's so exciting.
I know, I'm very excited about it. I also live here, so I'm like, come on, I want to see these BDAs. I think we need them, and it'd be amazing to have that in our landscape and to use it really as an educational tool as well, to help people start to reimagine what this place looked like before the fur trade, before the colonization by Europeans. What did it look like here? What could it look like again? So that if beavers show up, it's a little bit less shocking.
You know what I did last night? I set an alert on Google Scholar for Emily Fairfax beaver research. So I won't miss any of your forthcoming work. How does everyone else follow along with your work who are not setting alerts on Google Scholar?
Well, definitely set the alerts for my academic papers. But in the absence of that, I do have a public Twitter account that is a nonstop stream of beavers, beaver facts, beaver videos, me retweeting other people's beaver stuff. So if you want to be in the know on the state of beaver science, it's at Emily Fairfax, pretty straightforward. You can also go to my professional website, which is emilyfairfaxscience.com. And I keep copies of my papers there. And I also do little TLDR, or too long didn't reads, about what I found and why it's important. So if you don't want to read my whole paper, which is totally understandable, you can go to my website and pull up one of my projects and be like, what did she find about beavers and droughts? What did she find about beavers and fires? And you can get it in a little two-sentence sort of soundbite.
Dr. Emily Fairfax, on a mission to re-beavify California. Thank you so much, Emily.
Of course.
We'd like to acknowledge the Wildlife Conservation Board, the Department of Water Resources, and the Tuolumne County Resource Conservation District, as well as the residents of California, whose support of Prop 84 and Prop 1 made this podcast possible. Thanks to Ryan Evans for editing and mixing. Our theme music was done by Todd Hannigan. Thank you for joining us for this episode of The Water Table. See you next time.